Welcome to Parents Perspective. Settle down, please, students, Mrs. Cameron addressed her class of fourth graders. When I call your name, come up to the front of the room and tell about your costume for the play. A lot of murmuring and squirming ensued, and then a hush as the teacher began. Harriet, would you tell us about your costume? Yes, Mrs. Cameron. Harriet proudly marched to the front of the room in a long velvet skirt and white satin blouse. She had an ornate purple shawl around her shoulders. Her hair was dusted with talcum powder, and a purple velvet ribbon decorated it. I am Abigail Adams, wife of the second president of the United States, she declared. Last week, my mom and I bought my blouse and this shawl, and the skirt was my sister's. We shortened it. These earrings are my mom's, but the hair, she smiled, is mine. Very nice work. Thank you, Harriet. Mrs. Cameron nodded. Now, Bethany, would you tell us about yours? Bethany stood up and looked down at her feet.
I don't have my costume.
Why not? Mrs. Cameron looked closely at Bethany.
Well,
Bethany fidgeted with her chair. She doesn't have anything to wear, whispered Margaret to Darlene in a voice nearly everyone could hear. Bethany's eyes filled with tears. Bethany, why don't we talk after class? Mrs. Cameron suggested. You may sit down. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about and how can we respond to the plight of children living in poverty? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has worked for many years with families in difficult circumstances. Dr. Judith Madden is a licensed clinical professional counselor with more than 25 years of experience in education and mental health. She served as an elementary school counselor and pupil personnel worker in the Montgomery County, Maryland public schools, providing support to children and families in several high-poverty school communities, and was the county supervisor of school counseling services for 6 years before retiring in 2005. Judy is currently the director of NCommon, the Multicultural Mental Health Initiative of the Mental Health Association of Montgomery County, Maryland, a program that focuses on the mental health needs of immigrant families. She's the proud mother of three terrific adult sons. Welcome to Parents Perspective, Dr. Madden.
Thank you so much. I'm really delighted to be here.
What would you say is the biggest challenge children living in poverty have to overcome?
Poverty is incredibly stressful. It is environmentally stressful, physically stressful, emotionally stressful, and youngsters living in poverty are dealing with those stressors every day. And in fact, many of the challenges begin before they're even born, because moms who are pregnant and poor and hungry may not have adequate nutrition during pregnancy, may not have adequate medical care. And so youngsters are more likely to be low birth weight and to bring into the world as they enter some of the challenges that will stick with them throughout their lives. So the real challenge for these kids is learning to cope on a daily basis with the numerous, numerous stressors that are just part of what it means to be poor in this nation.
Is it more stressful for poor youngsters in an environment where they're some of the few who are poor rather than in an environment where everybody's poor?
I think it hurts to be poor. Certainly, if everyone around you is poor, you have less of a sense of being different than if you're in an environment where there's an extreme tension between the haves and the have-nots. And then being a have-not is very dramatic, and you're very aware of, such as in this story that you began, the times when you may not be able to meet expectations because there isn't the money to do that.
What are the kinds of behavioral coping mechanisms that poor children tend to develop in situations, for example, such as the one in the story?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of research suggesting that kids who live in poverty are more likely to be depressed, more likely to be anxious, and so their behavior may reflect that. They may be withdrawn. They may be uncertain in different kinds of circumstances in school or in the community, anxious about how they'll perform, anxious about the situation itself and what it may require of a family that can't necessarily meet those needs. There's also some research suggesting that kids who live in poverty are less likely to develop good behavioral controls, not because there's anything intrinsically wrong with them, but often when families live in poverty, it's hard for adults to be around to supervise kids and to help them really learn the rules of behavior that are essential for being successful in a school setting. Often, and I remember this very well from when I was a school counselor, the rules on the street when you live in a poor neighborhood are different from the rules in school. And so kids, to survive, need to know those street rules. And that may be that you respond to someone with aggression, whereas in school, that's totally unacceptable. So there's that ongoing tension and challenge between kind of the norms of schools, which tend to be pretty middle class, and the norms of an environment in which the rules might be different.
I'm beginning to have this immediate picture of poor areas of most cities where there's violence out of proportion to the number of residents.
Absolutely. And so kids learn early on that violence is a way to resolve problems. And they also tend to develop the anxiety and sometimes even full-blown traumatic stress disorder that comes from living in a violent environment. And then they bring that with them when they come to the schoolhouse. So they may be hypervigilant, you know, kind of always looking around, checking to see, is someone going to hurt me? And they may have a tendency to respond, again, to violence or even a slight that others may not interpret that way, as if they're in danger. Because, in fact, in their environment, often they are in danger.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion about children living in poverty.
Popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Judith Madden about children who must live in poverty.
Dr. Madden, how can parents and other family members help to cushion the shame and isolation so many poor children feel?
That's a very challenging question, especially when we begin with the parents of these youngsters. Because again, adults who live in poverty have increased levels of depression and anxiety and may have been experiencing domestic violence, may themselves have been victims as children of violence. So these are parents who hurt and who may themselves bring a sense of shame and isolation to their parenting. There's an increased likelihood that they would have been young parents or single parents, so they may not have the resources to draw upon. Again, I remember from when I worked in schools that often kids would ask me how old I was, and at that time I was in my late 30s and early 40s, and very comfortable telling them how old I was. And they would say, well, that's how old my grandma is. So they would talk about, again, this generational poverty where young women were having babies very young, and then that was reproduced over several generations. These moms and, when available, dads have to really be equipped themselves with the skills that will enable them to feel successful, which may mean job programs, educational programs that can help parents succeed. So mom isn't worrying constantly, will I have enough food to feed my children? Will I have enough money to pay my rent? Do I have transportation to take the kids to school or to a therapy session? Or can I pay the pediatrician this month? So I think a critical piece is supporting the family as a whole so that the parents can begin to feel pride and success in who they are and then begin to teach these skills to their children. That said, there's still a lot that teachers and other community members can do to serve as mentors and role models and to help youngsters with some of the skills that they may have not learned in their communities. Not, again, because poor parents are not good people, but because poor parents are very busy holding on by their fingernails and may not have had the opportunity to learn these skills themselves.
It's interesting. I'm thinking that a thread that seems to be going through this is behavior and behavioral expectations in the community at large. And the children are not getting it because they're out on the street. But the parents may not be able to give it, not only because they're not there, but because if their childhood was the same, then they don't bring to their parenting and interpersonal relations at large the kinds of behavioral expectations that we have.
Yeah. And there's really a clash sometimes between the kinds of skills you need to survive in a world of poverty and the skills you need to be successful in school. So it's not only the violence that we talked about earlier, but there's a great unpredictability. Do I need to move instantly? Do I have to be prepared for just instant changes? So often these are not families that have had the experience of doing a lot of long-term planning and a lot of long-term goal setting. The orientation is right now. It's what do we need to do to make it today? And again, schools, particularly now as they emphasize everybody needs to go to college, everybody needs to look to the future, build a strong career, schools are very future-oriented. There can be a real clash again between families that think about, what am I going to do today? I'm thinking now about some youngsters I worked with that were immigrant youth. And I want to add that kids in immigrant families are more likely to be living in poverty than children of native-born families, even though often both parents are working. But this youngster who was about 16 years old, there was an announcement on the PA about, you know, go to the career center to get SAT materials. And he said, it doesn't even make any sense to bother. And I said, well, talk about that. What's going on? And he said, well, I have a job after school, and I'm bringing in money to my family, and they can't think about my going to college. He doesn't qualify for financial aid because it turned out this was an undocumented youth, so there was no way to pay for it. His parents had gone through, I think, fourth grade in their home country. So for this youngster to make it to 11th grade was a huge, huge accomplishment for this kid. They needed his income, and they couldn't afford for him to not work and take classes even at the local community college because his income was essential to maintaining the family stability.
What can the community do in a situation like that?
It's very challenging. This speaks to legal issues and policy issues that I think we as a nation as a whole have to be thinking about, particularly, again, the large numbers of youngsters who come in as children undocumented through no fault of their own, but are really struggling then to be able to access resources because immigrants, even legal immigrants, can't access federal resources. So communities often have to struggle to make up the difference. And the fear for immigrant communities often, again, even if a child is born in the United States, hinders a parent's willingness to come forward and access services.
What problems are young adults most likely to have to face after a childhood in poverty? You've touched on this a little bit. Is there more that we need to know?
Kids who live in poverty are much less likely to graduate from high school. They're much more likely to have repeated a grade, which means that they're probably not as successful in their secondary schools. They're much, much less likely to go on to post-secondary education and to even know, again, what it takes to plan for a goal, develop a goal, and take the steps necessary for it, because that hasn't been something that's been part of their experience. They've learned often that hard work, and they see a lot of hard work every day, but that hard work doesn't always get you anywhere. Hard work may leave you standing still or may even result in your backpedaling because family members who've worked hard and maybe multiple jobs still can't make ends meet. So these are young people who often don't bring a sense of hope to their future. Again, they have a sense of, well, I'll make ends meet. I'll do what I can today. I'll get a job today, and we'll worry about tomorrow tomorrow.
Are these youngsters who also grow up to think that maybe they're not going to survive too far into adulthood?
Well, and again, depending on the community in which they live, I guess I want to be careful with everything that I've said. I don't want to overgeneralize or make the assumption that every statement about children in poverty is true for every poor child. But when youngsters grow up in communities where violence is much more the norm, then there is often a real fatalistic sense that, why should I plan for the future? I may not live beyond 18. And that's despair. That's a sense of hopelessness that makes it very hard for a kid to see purpose in any aspect of his or her life.
Why do you think family poverty as it affects children today might be different from how it was in other eras?
Most kids, no matter what their family circumstance, have a television at home, for instance. You watch TV and you see the lifestyles of the rich and famous or not so famous, and you look around and are very acutely aware of what it means for you to be poor and what you don't have access to. Poverty today tends to be more concentrated in urban areas than it did in the past, with very high-density living situations where there may be lots and lots of families in a single dwelling or a single apartment. So some of those circumstances might vary. Children of poverty in the United States are disproportionately African-American and Latino, children of color. And so not only are they and their families struggling with the challenges around poverty, but they're also dealing with racism and all of the pain and hurt and barriers that are part of that. So they often carry a multiple burden. There's a greater percentage now of single-parent households than there were, let's say, in the Depression. But that said, I think the biggest difference is now we understand the impact of poverty. And that in an era where my parents grew up, for instance, they thought, okay, so you're poor, so what? Doesn't matter. Now we understand it does matter, and that there is a greater likelihood of mental health problems, physical problems, substance abuse, domestic violence, that poverty erodes a youngster's ability to reach his or her potential. You could, in the Depression, without a lot of education, still find some way to bring some income into your family. I mean, my father used to talk about peddling rags and selling oranges. He could actually make a living doing that as a young boy and help his family. In today's economy, it's a lot harder to have a low level of education and to be able to bring some income into the family.
When you have an unskilled job, it can be taken away tomorrow.
You just have much less control over your life. And so that's a piece when we come back to the school setting, for instance, when schools expect mom or dad or both to come to a conference for a youngster, forgetting that if mom is working as a housekeeper or has three jobs, she's not available to do that. Because if she doesn't work, she doesn't get paid. Or if she doesn't work, she may lose her job. And there's only a limited number of times that you can say to your employer, I have to go to my son's school today, before the employer says, sorry, we need to hire somebody else. So there's much less control that someone who is in a low-paying job has over his or her job life than someone who is a professional or in a different kind of job where you have annual leave or you have sick leave or those kinds of things, and you know that you have a little bit of flexibility in your work life.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on children living in poverty.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. Today we are talking with Dr. Judith Madden about children living in poverty.
I guess the other thing that we're sort of skirting around is it seems like there are today multiple generations that have grown up in poverty, whereas in other eras it would be a group that would come in and be poor, but then the kids would make it.
There is still today generational poverty and situational poverty. Situational poverty being a family where suddenly there's been a reversal of financial health because of maybe an illness or a divorce or someone's lost a job, and it's kind of an acute situation, but that family has had the opportunity to grow up with some degree of financial stability, and so some of these other challenges may not be there. But we also have many, many millions of youngsters living, as you say, in generational poverty, which is two or more generations having lived poor, where the resiliency of the family has just been eroded. And from, again, the constant stressors, the lack of the family to develop a set of resources, it becomes more and more acute and intense with almost each generation. They're not seeing success stories. They're not hearing success stories. It's much more difficult to then envision yourself in a brighter future. Mm-hmm. I think some of the differences between some of the immigrant families that come here and may be very poor, but also have come here, whether they're documented or not, seeking a better life for their children. And so that's a very passionate driving force for families to say, all right, you know, in my home country, this happened, but I want my child to get an education. Now, they may not realize that in the United States, getting an education means going beyond high school. It's hard for kids to see that success is possible. And that's the role I think that other adults in the community can play, introducing role models to kids that say, look, this person made it. And this is how they made it. They figured out where they want to be. They started figuring out the steps they needed to take to get there. They started at step one. What would you like to do? And what's step one for you? And that's a really important role, I think, that educators, community members, members of religious groups, Boy Scout leaders, Girl Scout leaders, all of us need to be playing to really help kids build dreams and know how to get there.
We've done some programs on some of the after-school activities that give kids skills that are life skills. For example, if you know how to cook, you can get a little bit better job than just emptying trash cans.
Absolutely.
Because you have a real skill. Children need some guidance in finding those kinds of programs, and schools need more support in providing them.
Mm-hmm. Are there certain worldviews that are more common in poor youngsters? Are they less trustful or more materialistic?
I think when your world is constantly unstable, constantly unpredictable, it's hard to believe in a world that isn't like that. And so often, and again, not always, I want to keep coming back to that caveat, but often youngsters who've grown up in poverty do have less sense of trust in the universe, other than trusting the universe will be totally unpredictable. There's also sometimes a sense of needing to keep secrets, either secrets about the fact that we're so poor and I can't afford to pay for the field trip. For instance, most school systems find the percentage of kids in high school who sign up for free and reduced meals drops precipitously. Mm-hmm. Because high school kids don't want to step forward and say, I can't afford lunch. And so kids who can't afford lunch are pretending they can because that feels better. There's secrets, and they may involve family violence, may involve experiences with physical abuse or child abuse, substance abuse that parents are living with. And sometimes that affects the worldview of a youngster living in a family that's really struggling. How do I demonstrate to the world that things are okay, even though they may not be? So it's not only can I trust the world, can I trust the people around me with secrets? And what secrets do I share? What secrets do I not share? Again, when you think about immigrant youth, and particularly kids who may be in families without documentation, there is a great deal of fear. There's a sense of, I can't necessarily trust the government or the community because there's the potential to be sent back to my home country. Mm-hmm.
And I would think even in documented immigrants, if you've come from a country where you absolutely can't trust the government, you can't trust the police, you can't trust the authorities, you are not going to necessarily avail yourself of anything where you have to register anything.
Right. And kids and families who've experienced trauma, either because they were born here and the family's been traumatized, or they were born in other locations, there was trauma there or trauma in their journey to the United States, which is very typical.
And I guess because children are more apt to personalize everything, whatever it is probably perceived as directed at them.
Well, kids see themselves as the center of the universe developmentally. That is their job.
That's true.
And so, yeah, they do often perceive that things are directed towards them.
What resources could you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue further some of the issues we've been discussing?
There is a fabulous website by the National Center for Children in Poverty, www.nccp.org. The Education Trust is www.edtrust.org. And they do a lot of work around the achievement gap between youngsters of color and their white peers and the impact of poverty in education. And that's also a terrific resource. Mm. Ruby Payne is an educator who's done a lot of writing about poverty. Her book, A Framework for Understanding Poverty, is a really good resource. A terrific book called Enrique's Journey, which is the story of a boy's odyssey to reunite with his mother in the United States. That's written by Sonia Nazario.
Well, Dr. Judy Madden, you have been a fabulous resource for us and for all our listeners about the issues of children living in poverty. So thank you so very much for being with us.
And I thank both of you. This is a really important issue, and I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to talk about it. So thank you.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Raising a Successful Child: Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 329 and tell us, if you can, what station you are listening to.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the American Psychiatric Foundation. After you hear this show, it will be of special help to us if you would complete the very brief survey you'll find on our website in reference to it. Please go to www.parentsperspective.org, show number 329, and you will see a survey that you can click right onto there. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.